John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my rock?
Now the N is for not, oh no, my phone's just sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is tie is this, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Monday, June the 20th, 2011. After the recent burning of its mosque, on Friday, a group of extremist Israeli settlers torched Palestinian farmlands planted with wheat in the El Morir village, north of the central West Bank city of Ramallah. Israeli paper Haaretz reported on Friday that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu believes that there can be no peace agreement with the Palestinians unless they recognize Israel explicitly as a state for the Jewish people. On Friday evening, a Lebanese court sentenced an army officer to 20 years imprisonment after convicting him of spying for Israel. 25 Palestinian political prisoners in the Al-Ramla Israeli detention facility are facing imminent death due to illegal Israeli policies that deprive the detainees of their right to medical treatment. More than 200 Palestinians have died in Israeli prisons due to said illegal Israeli policies of medical negligence since Israel occupied the West Bank and Gaza Strip in 1967. In addition, several Palestinians were shot and killed by arresting soldiers and officers. On Saturday, an Egyptian official told Israeli reporters that there are active negotiations taking place with Palestinian resistance groups for the potential release of the Palestinians' only Israeli prisoner, a soldier captured 5 years ago in Gaza. However, he added that Israel's continued obstinance in the negotiation process could lead to soldier Gilad Shalit's disappearance. Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak has stated that he believes the United States will use its veto power at the Security Council in order to prevent an international recognition of an independent Palestinian state this coming September. On Sunday, Eliza Marom, head of the Israeli Navy, issued a strict warning to the organisers of the Freedom Flotilla in his speech dubbed as the Hate Flotilla that will be heading to the besieged Gaza Strip later this month in order to deliver humanitarian supplies. Flotilla organisers affirmed the peaceful nature of the flotilla and their determination to proceed to Gaza. On Sunday, the Miles of Smiles humanitarian convoy entered into the Gaza Strip via the Rafah border terminal between Gaza and Egypt, carrying 50 human rights activists, medical and humanitarian supplies. According to Al Jazeera, the announcement of an interim unity government between political rivals Fatah and Hamas has been delayed due to disagreement between the two sides as to who would hold position of prime minister. Former Israeli army chief Gabi Ashkenazi has warned Israel that it should return to negotiations with the PA to ward off Palestinian attempts to declare statehood in September, according to the Jerusalem Post newspaper. The Jerusalem municipality has agreed to the expansion of 2,000 settlement homes in Ramat Shlomo in occupied East Jerusalem. This occurred on Sunday. The plan allows for each settlement household to build an additional room, according to a council press statement. Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak has justified construction in Ramat Shlomo and elsewhere to France 24 television news network, stating that there is no way to end construction in the West Bank. He pointed out that over 500,000 settlers live here, all settlements illegal under international law. A Palestinian man was severely injured when Israeli soldiers shot him in the legs for allegedly carrying a knife at a checkpoint near the northern West Bank city of Qalqilya on Sunday. The Prime Minister of Malaysia has voiced his support for the upcoming Freedom Flotilla of aid ships and 500 supporters from around the world who plan to enter Gaza by sea on June the 27th. A ship from Malaysia joins two new French ships added to the roster of about a dozen ships set to sail to Gaza next week. On Monday, Israeli soldiers detained 14-year-old Mohammed Hamamra after entering his home and searching the house. The town of Hussan near Bethlehem in the southwest bank has been a target for Israeli military action due to its proximity to the settler town of Beit Arilit, built in 1984. Villagers have complained of regular settler attacks in the village and of Israeli house demolitions and land confiscation. According to the Palestine News Network, Salam Fayyad is to refuse the position of Palestinian interim government prime minister in the interests of national unity. This was disclosed according to sources close to the current PM. Israeli soldiers demolished on Monday 7 Palestinian homes and tents that belonged to residents of Khurbat Bir al-Ad, east of Yatta, near the south and west bank city of Hebron, according to the PAL Telegraph. Troops and members of the border guards invaded Yatta and proceeded to demolish the structures and uprooted crops close to the Masyaya illegal Israeli settlement, which was built on lands confiscated from the residents of the town. Local sources reported that 90 residents, most of whom were shepherds and farmers, previously inhabited the demolished homes. The Israeli Human Rights Organization for the Freedom of Movement, Gisha, have been fined 25,000 new Israeli shekels, which is approximately $7,250 United States dollars in legal fees, as part of a ruling against a case brought by the organization, which petitions for freedom of movement for Muslim Palestinians to travel to Muslim holy sites in Jerusalem. Israel is drawing up plans for a series of eventualities come September and a Palestinian declaration of statehood. The Migdal Oz plan, seen by the Ynet news organization, is the Israeli document on how the army plans to maintain order in the aftermath of September state bid. Israeli military officials in the GOC Central Command have outlined what they view to be potential scenarios come September in terms of Palestinian reaction to a declaration of statehood. The most likely scenario, according to commanders, is a period of reflection by Palestinians where they compare reality with their expectations. However, other scenarios include immediate protest and rioting and, according to some, all-out war. Israeli Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman has stated that Israel would consider a declaration of statehood by the Palestinians as reneging on previous Palestinian-Israeli agreements, including the 1994 Oslo Agreement, which established the Palestinian Authority. That's all for today from the IMEMC. This was Monday the 20th of June's daily roundup of news from the occupied Palestinian territories. We hope that you will join us again tomorrow. This report has been brought to you by Hossam Fassis and me, David Steele.
Some members of the U.S. Congress are now pressuring President Obama to reduce U.S. military operations in Afghanistan. Critics include longtime administration ally Massachusetts Senator John Kerry, head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, who now questions the expenditure of over $19 billion in foreign aid to Afghanistan over the past decade. During an early June hearing with new U.S. Ambassador to Afghanistan Ryan Crocker, Kerry complained that the deployment of 100,000 American troops now in Afghanistan is neither proportional to our interests nor sustainable. The U.S. war in Afghanistan currently costs $103 billion a year. President Obama is also facing counter-pressure from outgoing Defense Secretary Robert Gates and some top generals who want to limit troop reductions scheduled for July, which the president promised when he announced his surge of 30,000 additional American troops to Afghanistan last year. Meanwhile, in the House of Representatives, a growing coalition of liberal and conservative lawmakers are calling for a timeline for withdrawal of U.S. troops and for the handing over of military operations to the Afghan government. In May, an amendment to enact a timetable sponsored by Massachusetts Democrat Jim McGovern won 204 votes, including 26 Republicans. And in the Senate, Michigan Senator Carl Levin is calling for a drawdown of 15,000 troops from Afghanistan, while Indiana GOP Senator Richard Lugar warns that the large military force in Afghanistan diverts attention from other national security priorities, such as the debt crisis, energy policy, and controlling the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction.
Afghanistan today. NATO is reporting the death of a NATO soldier of unspecified nationality from an IED blast today in an undisclosed area in southern Afghanistan. Afghanistan, Saturday. 8 NATO troops of unspecified nationality were killed in a single day, 4 in the same vehicle accident. Afghanistan, Thursday. More than 200 militants crossed into Pakistan from Afghanistan early Thursday and attacked a border village with rockets, mortars, and machine guns, killing 5 people in a second such raid in 2 weeks, a government official reported. Afghanistan, Saturday. Suicide bombers attacked a police station near the presidential palace in the heart of the Afghan capital, killing 2 police officers. Afghanistan, Saturday. At least 15 more NATO fuel tankers were burned in the latest wave of attacks on NATO's fuel supplies. Afghanistan, Sunday. 3 men dressed in Afghan army uniforms attacked a police station near their presidential palace in Kabul. One detonated a suicide vest. The others continued the attack with automatic weapons. By the time security forces killed the remaining attackers 2 hours later, they had killed 3 police officers, 1 intelligence agent, and 5 civilians. Tolo News says 12 people were also injured in the attack. Afghanistan, Sunday. Suicide car bomb aimed at a convoy of German soldiers wounded 2 of them on the road leading to the airport in Kunduz City, according to the Minister of the Interior. Baghdad, Iraq, today. 7 people were wounded when a French embassy convoy was hit by a bomb in Baghdad in the second attack on the mission's vehicles in a month, an embassy official and local police reported. The attack was in Baghdad's Al Mesbah neighborhood, and an embassy spokesman said no French diplomatic or security personnel were hurt, but one of the convoy's vehicles was badly damaged. Baghdad, Iraq, today. 4 more bombs exploded in the city, including a car bomb, killing 1 person and wounding 9. Baltimore, today. The U.S. Conference of Mayors has passed a resolution demanding an accelerated end of the wars in both Iraq and Afghanistan, something they have not done since Vietnam. Mr. Barack Obama, these wars have gone nowhere in over 8 years. Now is the time to pull the plug, bring all the troops home today. Two Iraqi men were arrested in Bowling Green, Kentucky back in May. They are being charged in a grand jury indictment in U.S. domestic courts with supporting insurgents in their home country in occupied Iraq and with conspiring to bomb U.S. troops in Iraq, a country in which many people are engaged in a state of active warfare against the United States. In other words, U.S. domestic courts are claiming battlefield jurisdiction over the Iraq War. These 2 men are not charged with attempting to bomb anything or anyone inside the U.S. They are charged with trying to do something in Iraq, where U.S. courts are not supposed to have jurisdiction. The 2 men are Wad Ramadan Alwan, age 30, and Mohammed Sharif Hamadi, age 23. Assistant Attorney General Todd Heenan said, quote, Over the course of roughly 8 years, Wad Ramadan Alwan allegedly supported efforts to kill U.S. troops in Iraq, first by participating in the construction and placement of improvised explosive devices in Iraq, and more recently, by attempting to ship money and weapons from the United States to insurgents in Iraq. Similar charges have been filed against Hamadi. Supporting evidence against Alwan includes a fingerprint on a shell recovered in Iraq, which is not some place the FBI or U.S. courts are supposed to have jurisdiction, except for U.S. military courts, over offenses committed by members of the U.S. military. Alwan was said to have been drawn into an FBI sting in which he boasted of attacking the U.S. Army in Iraq. In September 2010, Alwan was said to have shipped money and weapons to Sunni insurgents in Iraq. Hey, Department of Justice and President Obama, how is it that U.S. courts do not have the jurisdiction to judge men being held without trial in Guantanamo Bay, supposedly captured on the battlefield, but do have jurisdiction over someone else on the battlefield? These two Iraqis should be considered soldiers of their country, every bit as much as the U.S. Navy SEALs who entered Pakistan on the mission to kill Osama bin Laden were soldiers of their country. They may even regard themselves as being on an anti-terrorism mission when you think about what the U.S. has done to Iraq. Therefore, the U.S. may, under the laws of war, either hold these men as declared prisoners of war and also grant prisoner of war status to all the men in Guantanamo Bay, or else grant trials in civilian court to every detainee in Guantanamo Bay, as well as to these two Iraqis. Many have argued that civilian trials for anyone captured on any battlefield will lead to court jurisdiction over every shell fired and every bomb dropped in every war. Many in the U.S., especially Republicans and members of the military, fear this scenario. Why then is it okay for Wad Ramadan Alwan and Mohammad Sharif Hamadi to face charges in U.S. court, but not okay for those suspected of war crimes in Iraq, such as those infamous Blackwater contractors, to face trial in the civil courts of Iraq? This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTradio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTradio@hushmail.com. There are those who say you can't fight City Hall. There are those who say protesting is a waste of time. In D.C., however, they've just been proven wrong. When D.C. Council Chairman Kwame Brown proposed to close all homeless shelters to avoid raising taxes on the rich, about 200 protesters swarmed the Wilson Building. When they went to Kwame Brown's office, some warned that if homeless people were turned out of shelters, riots would be next.
There were tent cities. And that's what this city is going to turn into if we don't save these benefits and shelters for people to live in. Now, also, after Dr. King's death, there were riots, or at least a riot, a terrible riot that affected a large part of the city. That can also happen. So you either go to jail now, or you go to jail next year.
They got that about the riots. As a result, Kwame Brown threw in the towel, and the shelters will stay open. He still chose to nickel and dime the middle class with fees instead of taxing the rich. But remember, it wasn't the middle class saying they would riot, and it wasn't the middle class looking at sleeping outdoors every night except during hypothermia season. Protest works. You can fight City Hall. Don't just vote. Organize. Get together with your neighbors and those you know the most. Stand up to Walmart. Stand up to City Hall. The 14th of June, the D.C. Council officially adopted a budget that keeps the homeless shelters open year-round and pays for some of the social services that were going to be abolished with a tax on out-of-state municipal bonds held by D.C.'s wealthy. Here's what homeless activist Eric Sheptock had to say about the budget hearings.
All up there and heard them saying that there might not be as much money as they had hoped for in the budget forecast, so they might not be able to replenish everything we hope for them to replenish, like the Housing Production Trust Fund to create affordable housing.
What does that mean for the shelter closing situation?
Actually, the shelters were saved on the first budget vote, which was on May 25th. There was a $20.5 million budget shortfall for the shelters, and they replenished $17 million back on May 25th. So we got back the vast majority of the homeless services money, and the shelters will be open year round. They won't be closing on April 1st. So we're fortunate in that respect.
But they're trying to chip away at it.
Yes. So they are chipping away. The budget shortfall of $20.5 million. Like I say, they put back $17 million. So we're short by $3.5 million still.
I guess it's going to come down to what that tax on bonds held by D.C.'s wealthy is going to produce.
Well, that got passed, the bonds tax.
So that's in the final budget?
Because you know as well as I do that they have to go through Capitol Hill. So we I hope that it survives Capitol Hill.
If Congress throws it out, the shelters close?
Well, it's kind of too soon to know what Congress is going to do, but if they reject the budget or if they make changes, we have to figure out, what to do from there. I don't think Congress really wants to put a whole bunch of folk on the streets of D.C.
Given that they have to walk on those streets.
Exactly. That's my very thought.
You heard that, Congress. Don't mess with the D.C. budget. If you turn people out on the street, you congressmen are going to have to deal with those consequences in the streets of D.C. We've had our share of protests here in D.C. against austerity programs and budget cuts, such as D.C. City Council Chairman Kwame Brown's failed attempt to close homeless shelters to save taxes on the rich. We've had our share of protests against the International Monetary Fund and its brand of austerity here in D.C. Greece, however, things are really hitting the fan as thousands of people take to the streets and fight, saying no to an IMF-demanded austerity program.
It's chaos in Greece. What was supposed to be a peaceful rally of 25,000 people against the country's new austerity measures instead broke down into violence Wednesday. Hundreds of protesters clashed with riot police, turning Athens into a smoke and tear gas-filled city, with rocks and firebombs being hurled through the air. Windows were smashed, and demonstrators say at least 10 people were injured in the melee. At the heart of the matter is a new government package of tax hikes and spending cuts that are needed to prevent the country from defaulting on its debts.
Well, so say the American mainstream press, the IMF and World Bank, and Wall Street investors. 75% of the Greek public is opposed to the bailout, and tens of thousands of Greek youth have shown they're willing to take to the streets and fight like something out of the movie 300 against these bailouts. If there's one thing worse than a sovereign default, it's poverty for all, which is what these bailout programs bring. And there's a message in what's happening in Greece for the Republican Party, for the Democratic Party, and yes, Mayor Gray and for Kwame Brown too. That is, if you cut people's legs out from under them, don't expect him to take it lying down.
A spike in staple food crop prices around the world has forced an estimated 44 million people into poverty over the past year. The International Aid and Development Group, Oxfam, recently predicted that without substantial reforms to the global agricultural system, food prices could double within the next 20 years, causing millions more to sink into poverty. Oxfam and other groups say that global climate change, speculation in agricultural commodities, and the diversion of corn into the production of biofuels are the primary causes of food price increases and the resulting rise in hunger. A related report titled Understanding Land Investment Deals in Africa, recently published by the Oakland Institute, an independent policy think tank, found that a large-scale land grab has driven local African farmers off their land and reduced food production. The Oakland Institute maintains that the same financial institutions that triggered the global recession by engaging in risky financial investments in real estate are now doing the same with the world's food supply. The consequences of increasing food prices are not limited to rising hunger, but have also led to political instability, which in turn have provoked food riots and, in some cases, the overthrow of governments. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Anuradha Mittal, executive director of the Oakland Institute, who talks about her group's report on real estate speculation across Africa and how that practice relates to the rise in global food prices.
Global hunger and increasing food prices have been a subject of much discussion since 2008, when we saw the food prices increase by 83%. So on one hand, while the United Nations started pointing out that with this increase in food prices, over a billion people today are characterized as being malnourished, as being chronically undernourished, and we're talking about one-sixth of humanity, the poorest people in the poorest countries, we saw a new trend happen. Rich countries, on one hand, such as the Gulf states, who are resource-rich, but they are poor when it comes to land and water, have been rushing to, say, the poor African countries to be able to take over their lands, prime agricultural land, so they can grow food for their own populations. You have also seen a trend of countries which might get food insecure or who are looking for opportunities to export, such as India, have also been rushing towards poor nations, for instance, in Africa, to take over these lands. And these two trends have been talked about by the media in the West. However, what has not been talked about much is also these private equity funds and hedge funds, who after the collapse of the housing market, who with the collapse of this whole dot-com bubble, are looking for new soft commodities to invest in. So they are also headed towards places like Africa in this land rush, where they're looking for arbitrage opportunities because the prices of land are so cheap and they're so rich in bounty, close to water, all kind of investor status and tax holidays they get. They have been rushing there and securing lands so they can profit while the people of Africa are losing their most fertile lands and starving.
Anuradha, maybe you can talk a bit about some of the speculation on the food commodity markets and how that is linked in with some of the very same financial firms, global financial firms, that many point to as the trigger, their reckless behavior as the trigger for the global economic collapse that we saw unfold these last few years and certainly we're still experiencing here in the United States and around the world.
Sure. I think what we have seen over the last few years, that complete deregulation of the food commodities markets. So you see private equity funds or hedge funds who have nothing to do with agriculture, pension funds, sovereign wealth funds, your JP Morgans and Goldman Sachs, and other new investment firms that are coming up, known as alternative investment firms, who are investing and who are speculating on commodities, right from the food commodities and setting its prices. So on one hand, while we see this skyrocketing of food prices and people blame it on increased consumption in places like China or India or growing world population, but if you look at these prices of commodities, they go up, in 3 months they go down, then they jack up again. It is really the result of the deregulation and actors who have nothing to do with agriculture being involved in this speculation. But also what this new series of reports that we have recently released, we look at a whole new trend, which is actually far more dangerous, that in addition to these funds being able to speculate on commodities, they're also now rushing to take over ownership of land, of water in countries, in places like Africa. And so they will not just dictate the price of commodities, but they will also control land and water, dictate what is grown, how it is grown, who gets to eat it. And this kind of vertical integration of a food system we have never seen before, which is very dangerous for the whole global food supply, not to mention the devastation it is causing to the communities in Africa.
I'm guessing correctly that this is an issue that needs substantially more media coverage to educate the public about these issues that affect really everybody, because we're all buying food. Maybe we're a bit insulated from some of these bigger issues in Africa and the horrendous problem of hunger, rampant hunger in Africa. You want to just say a word about media coverage?
This story, these reports, which are based on investigation, which are based on releasing documents that have never been seen before and contracts. It is amazing that the media around the world has picked it up as the number one story this whole past week. And we have had hundreds of thousands of media impressions from radio interviews in, you know, the leading radio in Dubai. But the so-called mainstream press in the United States is still quiet. When NPR listeners have listened to us, it has been through BBC. And it makes you question, where is the independent media? What happened to journalists in the United States of America?
That was Anuradha Mittal, director of the Oakland Institute. To find links to the Institute's recent report and additional information on global food prices, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
On the Xingu River in Brazil, authorities are once again trying to build a hydroelectric dam, now called Belo Monte. This dam was formerly known as Carrara, but that turned out to be the word for war, the language of an indigenous tribe opposing the dam, a tribe who threatened exactly that. The project has been stopped since 1975 by controversies over indigenous rights and forced displacement, but a license to begin construction was issued on the 1st of June this year. On the 20th of June, members of Amazon Watch and other supporters of indigenous rights in Brazil turned up outside the Brazilian embassy in Georgetown, much to the displeasure of corporate tenants of that same building.
As you may have noted, folks who own this building are trying to harass us and prevent us from being here because they don't like being embarrassed, they don't like the ruckus outside their building, and, you know, we're not trying to get arrested, but I think that if you're a business owner and you're renting to an institution that is carrying out destruction of indigenous people's land, you should expect protest. That's the
those who say that the whole reason the Europeans ever came to the Americas was because they destroyed their own rivers, the population of fish crashed, and the fishermen of Europe had to go farther and farther out to sea to find fish. Now they want to destroy the rivers of the Americas.
The fight to save an historic mountaintop battlefield site in West Virginia's coal country inspired hundreds of local residents and out-of-state supporters to undertake a 50-mile march in early June that followed in the footsteps of thousands of coal miners who marched the same route in 1921. The miners were demanding the right to join a union, in this case the United Mine Workers of America, and engage in collective bargaining. Demands that resonate today as those rights are under attack in states where conservative Republicans hold power. The Battle of Blair Mountain pitted miners against police and the mine owners' private security forces, resulting in an unknown number of casualties. Eventually, the U.S. Army was called in and ended the 10-day engagement, the largest armed labor confrontation in U.S. history. The battlefield is now threatened by mountaintop removal coal mining operations that have already damaged part of its 1,600 acres stretched across 10 miles of ridgeline. The site was designated a National Historic Site in 2008, but under pressure from mining interests, the designation has been withdrawn. Supporters are now trying to get it reinstated. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Kenny King, an active member with Friends of Blair Mountain, which organized the week's protest actions, along with the group Appalachia Rising. He describes the damage done by mountaintop removal and the impact he hopes the protest march will have on protecting the historic mountaintop.
Right now, what used to be Massey Energy is now Alpha Natural Resources. They have one called the Camp Ranch Surface Mine, which will wipe out a large portion of the battlefield, and it's actively working, and they're within, like, right now, I think they're within 1,700 feet of the ridge line, Spruce Fork Ridge, and they're moving that way, you know, pretty quick. But that's the only active one right now. There's a couple more that's been permitted by the state, and they just approved another 50.3-acre site amendment to a larger permit for Mingo Logan. And then you have a Atkins Fork surface mine, which is 332.9 acres, which will completely wipe out the southern end of the battlefield, including a lot of sites that were occupied by the actual mine or marching miners. So, you know, that area there is super important because it's got sites associated with both sides of the conflict. So that would be super important to protect right there.
So I interviewed some people along the march route, some of whom were supportive and some of whom weren't. And I've talked to a number of people in the state who think mountains are really useless, and it's better if you flatten them out, and then you can have industry and golf courses and prisons and different things. What do you say about that?
As far as putting industry up there, there's probably already in Logan County alone, I would say close to 40,000 acres that has already been flattened. And I would say when you count the permits that are being applied for and in the process, that you're looking at over 50,000 acres, which is coming close to 20% of the whole landmass of the county. And I don't see any development, very little. Well, matter of fact, the governor has a industrial park on one of the mountaintop removal sites, and I don't believe there's anything up there. Nobody wants to put anything up there because of the cost. You have to pump water up there constantly, and then you got to travel. You know, you got to climb the mountain and all that. So usually it's out in the middle of nowhere. There's nothing there. People don't want to locate in places like that.
Now, one thing he said, he also said that that's what they would do, and that he says nobody wants to go see the mountains. I guess he doesn't know about all the tourism in mountain states, but
you got the Hefner McCoy Trail. That's all about mountains. That's mountain trails. That's why they come in here, to ride these trails and see all these beautiful mountains, beautiful scenery and all that. I mean, that's ridiculous. They got nothing, really. They got no argument whatsoever. They know it, and, you know, they're just desperate to come up with some little silly thing, you know.
But, the other thing several people told me was, aside from development, they said there's way more wildlife on the mountaintop flattened sites than there was on the mountain itself, even though, you know, apparently it has more, the mountains in general, Appalachia has more biodiversity than almost anywhere in the world. But they said, I mean, these guys were saying, I go up there hunt all the time, and there's deer up there, and there's rabbits and all these things I never used to see. But do you think it's just because they never saw them because the trees were in the way?
Right, so that's what I was going to say. If you got two miles of clear, open field grass, you're going to see something out there. I mean, it just may seem like there's more. Hey, I don't know if there's been any scientific tests or studies done on it yet, but if there were, I'm sure they would show that all this has been dissected, bisected. You know, it's been just cut apart so much that it has to be affecting their habitat now. I mean, these deer are not going to go out in the middle of these big fields on a hot summer day and lay down or eat or whatever. They're going to go into the forest land where it's cool and where the water is and all that, you know. And that's ridiculous.
So just tell me briefly, you've been working, what, is it 20 years?
So
you've been working 20 years on this, and then there's people in the last maybe 10 years that have really started building a real movement around ending all mountaintop removal. So how did you guys, the two organizations, Appalachia Rising and Friends of Blair Mountain, how'd you come together?
Well, we got a common cause, I guess. You know, we're about preserving the history, and you can't separate it now because of all the mountaintop removal. You have to consider that because that's the biggest threat. I mean, you know, so we just got a common cause, I guess, you know. We're both working for the same thing, pretty much.
And what do you hope or think, predict, will come from this week-long march and this gathering and the march up the mountain?
If nothing else, a lot of national attention, and maybe some people will start wondering about it, and maybe they'll start contacting their politicians or whatever and try to, you know, convince them that there's got to be something done. We're going to have to search for a different fuel source and all that, and we can't keep on going down the same road we're going. We got to do something.
That was Kenny King, a board member with Friends of Blair Mountain. For more information on the groups fighting to save Blair Mountain, visit our website at btlonline.org.